And this is Shattering Myths, the program where we expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion, politics, and patriotism, along with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, my mission will be to help you understand why these things are occurring, to share what we can do to protect ourselves, while also predicting what these events portend for our future. Then, during our second hour, we will engage God on His terms by way of His covenant and through His Torah teaching, ultimately striving to replace religion with reason. Our phone number, should you want to question, criticize, or affirm anything that is said during today's program, is 877-300-7645. We have as a guest today David Hayden. We'll be with him in a moment. He has written a book on Islam's beginnings that I think is particularly relevant to the issues in today's news. So before we engage David in conversation, what I would like to do is share two items that appeared in the news today, because I think that both of them bring relevancy to his research. First, this morning I watched on the Today Show a U.S. senator be interviewed regarding what occurred in Libya. We know now that Barack Hussein Obama provided a window into his soul regarding his explanations on the nature of the attack, the identity of the attack on the Benghazi embassy, which led to the deaths of four Americans. He chose deliberately, when he knew otherwise, to blame the attack on what he referred to as an extremist and repulsive movie, one that actually presented Mohammed's life correctly, even though it was very poorly produced. And that is because this president is committed to conducting a war against all forms of extremism, as opposed to recognizing that the source of Islamic jihad is Islam. We know for certain, and we knew in advance, that the raid on our embassy was conducted by fundamentalist Muslims operating under the title Friends of Sharia, Ansar al-Sharia. And yet this president deliberately and purposefully lied to the American people, not only in the wake of that attack, but for weeks thereafter, trying to promote his myth that the killings occurred as a result of an extremist movie. The second item that I would like to bring to your attention again is the General Petraeus and Allen affair that has revealed the darkness of their character and also gives us the opportunity to focus on the consequence of their behavior, which was to double the number of Americans killed in Afghanistan, behavior that led to the death of over a million individuals in Iraq, and with most of the Americans most recently killed in Afghanistan, killed because they empowered and armed the Afghan army, which is operating under a completely different mindset, a completely different religious perspective than we're willing to acknowledge, which is why we armed the enemy of the very men who killed Americans. All the while, General Allen sent 3,000 letters to a love interest in the United States. And of course, now we turn to Syria, and that is the legacy of General Petraeus, his awakening councils, where he decided that it would be wise to arm Sunnis so that they could combat Shia Islam. The transition that we witnessed in Syria, when it went from peaceful demonstrations to armed conflict, is all a result of General Petraeus arming the Sunni Mujahideen in Iraq, who crossed the border with their weapons and turned a peaceful demonstrations into a civil war. We have one more item in the news that also introduces our guest and his research. Over the last couple of days, over 200 Kabar rockets have rained down on Israel, thousands over the past few months, and this morning three Israeli civilians, two women and a man, were killed in their homes, and three children, one four, the other two infants, were severely injured in the most recent rocket attacks. Mujahideen in Gaza have simultaneously carried out scores of jihadist attacks on Israel during the past 3 weeks. During one such attack, a Muslim boy carrying an assault rifle crossed the border with other jihadists and is reported to have been shot by the IDF, which is what has escalated the most recent rounds of crossfire. And one of the founders of Hamas, their chief of jihad, their chief of suicide operations, their chief of rocket attacks, their chief of kidnap operations, Ahmad Sayed Kail al-Jabari, was killed by the Israelis. He, of course, is revered by the Muslims. He is one of the founders of Hamas. He is the one who promoted the kidnapping of innocent Jews to trade for convicted Islamic terrorists. He is the one who has orchestrated the rain of rockets. And now with Libya and Egypt under the control of Islamic fundamentalists, the flow of weapons into Hamas is now unabated. And so by their own words, the Muslim Mujahideen operating in Gaza are opening the gates of hell on Israel. So with this background, all in today's news, it's my pleasure to introduce David Hayden. David is the author of a new book called Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews, 1622 to 628, which marks the time in Yathrib, today's Medina, that Muhammad began to terrorize the first victims of Islam. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you, Yada?
I'm fine. Both of us have written books on Islam. I've shared my motivations before, but just as a reminder, I was flying back the morning of 9/11 and was rudely awakened by the attack on our buildings when it became evident that Islamic jihadists conducted suicide bombings of our buildings. And I was curious. I wanted to know why. I wanted to know whether or not they had corrupted their religion or whether or not their religion had corrupted them. And so, curious, I went off to meet with Al-Qaeda. I met with Islamic Jihad. I met with Hamas. I met with the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade. And I asked them, why are you killing us? And so it was then that I began my motivation for exposing the reasons behind Islamic Jihad. What were your motivations and what were your initial perceptions as you began this research some 10 years ago?
Well, you said 10 years ago, and 11 years ago was 9/11.
Correct.
9/11 was the catalyst for me, for sure. I was vaguely aware of what was going on in the Islamic world up until 9/11. I mean, I knew what happened in the embassies in Africa, and the attempt on the World Trade Center in 1993, the U.S. Sales coal attack, and so on. But it didn't really get me, really excited about trying to figure this all out. It was just part of the news, and I was just going along with it, and I was busy with my work and doing other things. But 9/11 really hit home, and like you, I wanted to know why these people did this, what motivated them,
right,
to do this. So
if you don't know that, David, the consequences, you'll declare war against the tactic they used, which is terrorism. And if you declare war against a tactic, you have zero chance of actually defeating the motivation behind the attacks.
That's true. But you mentioned in your introductory remarks the K-Bar rockets.
Yes.
K-Bar rockets are named after K-Bar, in 628, when Muhammad and his jihadists went into K-Bar and defeated them. And then, that's where the idea of Dhimmitude actually started there at K-Bar.
It's where the phrase Allahu Akbar was first used. And Allahu Akbar actually defines the very title that you have applied to your book.
Yes. Yes.
You know what Allahu Akbar means and why it was used in the raid of the town? It was a Jewish farming community. It was only a Jewish farming community because the first community in Yathrib, today's Medina, that Muhammad exiled, when he robbed them of their property and of their homes, they settled in Kabar. And then Muhammad, this, you can't really say he defeated them. He came down with a group of men under arms and launched a surprise attack against the civilians who were only armed with hoes and shovels. And it was before that attack, it was the first time Allahu Akbar was actually used as a slogan. Do you know what it means and why it was used at that time?
God is the greatest.
No, it does not. No, it doesn't mean God. Allah is a name. It's not a title.
Allah. Okay. Allah is the greatest. Is it?
Right. And he is now yelling this at the Yathrib, former Yathrib Jews, who have a God whose name is Yahweh. So by having them yell Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater, at a community of Jews, what's the message?
Well, the message to them is your God, my God, is greater than your God.
Well, correct. And have we therein defined the whole mindset of Islamic supremacism?
Yes, we have. I mean, Islamic supremacism is based on the idea that, you know, we are the jihadists need to make sure that the world is going to be safe for the spread of Allah's religion.
Correct. And by screaming Allahu Akbar and having Allah's only messenger come up with this title, have we also perhaps revealed the very character of the wannabe God named Allah?
Yes, we have.
And that wannabe God named Allah wants to be superior to whom?
To any other God.
Well, since there's only one God, he wants to be superior to the God of Abraham, Yishak, and Jacob, whose name is Yahweh.
Okay.
And therein you have the heart of Islam is revealed by what happened at Kabar.
Mm-hmm. I definitely agree with that.
Now, you wrote me and you said, as the title suggests, the book is an in-depth study of Muhammad's contentious battles with the Jews of Medina. And as you know, at the time, the place was not Medina. It only became Medina later. It was Yathrib.
Right.
And of course, named after the god of the Yehudim. The actual name for Jews is not Jew. It's Yehudim. And then their battles against Jews throughout Arabia. And when we return after the break, we're going to talk about the quotes that you used from the Quran and the Hadith and how you came about assessing which books were the oldest and most reliable sources of information on Muhammad and Islam's foundation. I am Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We have David Hayden as our guest today. He's the author of a new book on Islam and its formation. It's entitled Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews, 622 to 628. David, when you began your research, the single most important thing had to have been, how do you go about determining what are the oldest Islamic sources, what are the most credible Islamic sources? Because if you're going to write a book using evidence and reason, which is what you have done, the book can't be any better than your citations. So how did you go about choosing which you would include?
Well, I started reading several biographies of Muhammad, and the one that grabbed my attention the most was the one by Ishaq. Or at least it was a recension of Ishaq's work by Ibn Ishaq. And, you know, that was the real eye-opener for me to get into the life of Muhammad and to see how, you know, the revelations that he received from Allah, you know, motivated his whole life from that point.
So the book that you, did you read the Oxford Press by Ghulam translation of, okay. So what that means, you probably know this, but what, since Hisham redacted the Sirah considerably, so we don't actually have an extant copy of Ibn Ishaq's Sirah, and it was edited to present Muhammad in a more favorable light. To actually read it today, we become dependent on the oldest historical source, the second oldest actually historical source, but the oldest extant source, which is Tabari and his Tekrith, which is history. The Sirah and therefore the Tariq became your initial guide, and I can't think of any better tools.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that Hisham was quoted as saying that he didn't want to he didn't use everything that he found in Ishaq's notes. He left out parts that he thought were going to be offensive. And this just kind of brings into light the idea that, you know, if he, you know, writing as a pious Jew or a pious Muslim is going to write all this stuff and not consider it offensive, you know, I'd really be interested in seeing the information they left out. Because there's a lot of material in this book.
Yeah, that's a fact. The way that Muhammad is presented in that book, he is a sexist, he is a pedophile, he is a rapist, he is a mass murderer, he is a terrorist, he's an avowed liar. If that's the good part, can you imagine what was removed?
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, he takes credit in the book for 3 rapes. He takes credit for a number of sub-teen women whom he has sex with, which is pedophilia. He takes credit for having sex with his adopted son's wife. He takes credit for lying on as it relates to his attack on Mecca the first time so that he could go back and attack them the second time. It's a pretty disgusting portrait. I mean, Muhammad would have to be amongst the most repulsive men who ever lived if what's there is accurate.
True. Of course, there are Muslims today who discount the story. You know, they don't believe that story. But then there's the Hadith and there's also the Quran that all feed into the same idea.
Yeah, you know, David, there's a kind of an interesting correlation here that the Sirah, for example, by Ishaq, and the Tariq, which is the history by Tabari, who's also the writer of the first book explaining the Quran, they're comprised entirely of hadith. And when you think of it, the Quran itself is hadith. The Quran was passed on exactly the same way by exactly the same people for exactly the same period of time, orally, from mouth to ear, was it not?
That's true. I hadn't thought of it that way, but that is true. That's how transmitted is the generation.
And does not the Quran tell Muslims that they should follow not only Allah's orders, but Muhammad's orders?
Yes, that's true.
And are Muhammad's orders found in the Quran?
Muhammad's, yes, they definitely are.
No, Muhammad's orders aren't found in the Quran. The Quran is supposed to be Allah talking.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you meant the orders from Allah.
No, yes. So if you were to listen to the Quran and do what it says, which is to follow Muhammad's orders, now you can follow Allah's orders in the Quran and you'll be a terrorist. But if you were, since you were ordered in the Quran to follow Muhammad's orders, would you not have to read the Hadith to know Muhammad's orders?
Yes, you would.
So the Hadith is absolutely required to be a Muslim, correct?
That's right. That's right.
And so the oldest collection, we'll be back in a moment, but the oldest collection of Hadith that comes down to us today is Ishaq's Sirah, the very book that David began writing and researching the history of Islam. Wise choice.
Yes.
Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We have as our guest today David Hayden. David has written a new book on Islam called Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews, 622 to 628. David, you've done something that I admire probably more than most anything else. You sought to use evidence and reason to present the case for what is happening today so that people might understand why Muslims are not only anti-Semitic, but why they're trying to impose their religion on the world. And you began with a book, the Sirah, which means biography. It is the biography of Muhammad. It's a compilation of hadith regarding Muhammad's words and deeds. I want to ask you a couple of questions that I think help underscore the appropriateness of you beginning there. The first of those is, does the Quran ask Muslims to follow Muhammad's example?
Yes, it does.
Yes, it does. Is Muhammad's example presented in the Quran, or do you have to read the Hadith to know Muhammad's words and deeds?
You have to read the Hadith to understand. I mean,
and the oldest collection of Hadith.
Muhammad's only mentioned four times in the Quran. So
correct.
Referred to as messenger throughout the Quran. But yeah,
correct.
To really understand what he's all about, you have to read the Hadith.
So it is impossible to follow the Quran's instructions to exemplify Muhammad, which, by the way, would make you a terrorist. It would also make you a rapist and a pedophile and a sexual pervert. But it is impossible to follow Muhammad's example without reading and knowing the Hadith, the oldest extant collection of which is found in the Sirah. Correct?
I think that would be true.
So anybody a Muslim that would discount the Sirah, which is the first chronological presentation of the words and deeds of Muhammad, would be a hypocrite.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think you could say that, but I think that they could, they just, maybe they don't want to believe it. Maybe, you know, that,
yeah,
I think
I'll
there are Muslims out there that simply just don't want to believe that Muhammad could have done that, because if they did, then it's not the Muhammad that they believe in. You know what I mean? So
correct.
I think they can live in a fantasy world, but
correct.
The reality is that this is what most pious Muslims believe. You know, they believe the Sirah, the Hadith, and so on.
Well, if the Sirah is not true, right? If the Sirah is not true, if it's not an accurate presentation of Muhammad's words and deeds, then Islam ceases to exist because there is none other.
Well, that's true. I mean, historically, that's true. You'd have the Quran, but there's very little in there that actually identifies what happened. There's no real history there. You can't really develop a history.
That brings me to my next question. Does the Quran in Surah 2106 have a statement that explains Quranic contradictions? And it says that when we eliminate a verse and we throw it into oblivion and we bring out a better one, which means that the only way for you to know which one of Allah's statements is untrue and has been replaced by something different is to be able to order the Quran, which is now a jumbled mess, chronologically. Would that not be required?
Yes, it would be, and that's called the abrogation.
Right. Now, is that possible? Without the Sirah, is it possible to arrange the Quran chronologically?
It would be very difficult, I think.
Yeah, it would be impossible.
Very difficult.
Yeah, it would actually be impossible. And so without the Sirah, Islam actually ceases to exist and the Quran becomes an impossible document to follow.
I think that would be true. Yeah.
So your justification in using the Sirah as a primary resource is therefore validated.
Yeah. Yes.
When you wrote me the initial letter, you said the following. Therefore, understanding this story, and you're speaking of the story of Muhammad's initial assault on Jews in Yathrib, it will enable the reader to become more aware of Allah's revelations and Muhammad as the messenger of those revelations as the primary sources of violent jihad throughout Islamic history.
Yes.
That statement being true, you wrote it, I happen to agree with it, would you and have you come to the conclusion then that Islamic jihadists have not corrupted their religion, but instead that their religion, as presented by Muhammad and his wannabe God, have corrupted them?
Yeah, I talk about that in the conclusion of the book, that's the conclusion I came to, that the, you know, the people that talk about Islam as a religion of peace, I've got to prove using reason and facts and so on to show that that Muhammad was a man of peace. But what are they going to use to support that? I definitely agree with what you're saying.
Let's go to back in time. Muhammad was exiled from Mecca following the satanic verses in shame. And what is the first thing that by Mohammed Did. It happens to be the Pledge of Aqaba. I'm sure you've found this in your studies. Do you recall what the Pledge of Aqaba contained, what it was about?
The first or the second pledge?
Yeah.
When I was 620, there was the first pledge, and then the second pledge.
And what was the summation of the Pledge of Aqaba?
That people who were going to follow Muhammad had to be ready to fight with Muhammad. And in other words, that there was going to be warfare involved here. That, you know, to further the ideas from the revelations that he received from Allah, there was going to have to be confrontation with people who be infidel, whether
Correct.
Christian or Jew or pagan, whatever it may be.
Yeah, in fact, it was all-encompassing. It was all-encompassing, was it not? He says, the Pledge of Aqaba says that on behalf of Muhammad, we pledge to wage war against all humankind.
Right, right. And that, so that really is before he gets to Medina.
That is correct.
At that time.
Correct.
So,
that was in Rome.
I make a point in the book that there were signs of his aggressiveness, his idea of conquest when he was living in Mecca. Even
correct.
Though he, for the most part, you know, he didn't have any power there. He had very few
correct.
Supporters there. But there were signs. I know at one point he was confronted by some of the Meccan, you know, Quraysh, and they were talking about how he's bad-mouthing their religion and so on, and he was bad-mouthing theirs back and forth. And,
mm-hmm.
and he said, well, you know, the God who supports me is going to bring disaster upon you. I'm not quoting that word for word, but
yeah.
there was a statement to that effect, and this is well before the time that he left, that he was talking about how...
Correct.
Yes, he get you guys.
Yeah, in fact, if you look at the Meccan surahs, the torture that Muhammad described that would be perpetrated on the Meccans who were opposed to him are just absolutely revolting. You know, tearing people's skin off and cover, making them drink molten pitch. It goes on and on and on as to what his God was personally going to do to everyone who opposed him. And so you're right. The cat was out of the bag very early on in terms of Muhammad's violent streak, and it became known as the Pledge of Aqaba en route to Yathrib. So before he actually met the first Jew, he was already preparing to wage war against all mankind.
Right.
All right, then he comes to Yathrib. It is primarily a Jewish community. Two of the three, or three of the five tribes in Yathrib are Jewish. Muhammad then becomes dependent on the Jews for two things, does he not?
Well, he's dependent. He really, when he arrived there, I think he thought that maybe being an idealist or whatever, but he thought that the Jews would be on his side, that they would recognize him as the messenger of Allah, and that he's the final prophet and all this, but that didn't quite work out.
I don't believe that's the case. I think that's more recent copying, editing. I think Muhammad knew full well that he was full of it. I think that's only put there to, in retrospect, the two things that Muhammad was dependent on the Jews for is that he and his fellow Muslims didn't work, and therefore to live, they borrowed money from the Jews. That's the reason why interest is condemned in the Quran. The Muslims borrowed money to eat and for shelter from the Jews. And the second thing is that almost every surah that was revealed in Yathrib, today's Medina, has components that are twisted variations of Talmud readings.
Okay.
So Muhammad actually created much of the Quran out of Jewish Talmud readings, and he financed his religion initially by borrowing money from the Jews. Didn't want to pay it back, and didn't like the fact that the Jews knew. In fact, the Quran says this really explicitly, that Muhammad knew that the Jews held the goods on him, that they knew that he had developed his Quran from their Talmud and twisted it to serve his interest. So what was the easiest thing to do with those people if you didn't want to pay back the loans and you didn't want to be held accountable for what you had done?
Attack them.
Correct. So the first attack, what was the first Jewish community that Muhammad attacked?
The Banu Qaynuqa.
Right. And what did he do to them?
What did he do to them? He ultimately exiled them.
That's correct.
A lot that went before that. You know, there's some controversy over what really started. You know, the girl in the marketplace that, you know, where they made the joke on her and so on. But I think ultimately, I think what you're saying is probably true about what happened. That there was you know, they were indebted to the Jews.
Yeah.
I know it's in my reading there. I recall, I don't remember who I quoted there, but there was a statement made that it's more economic than it was anything else, or between Muhammad and the Qaynuqa, because they were the people that ran the marketplace. And there was word going around that Muhammad was going to start his own marketplace, and he wasn't going to charge interest like the Jews did. And that was part of the animosity between the...
Yeah.
Between the Qaynuqa Jews then.
Yeah. Did Muhammad ever start a marketplace? Did Muhammad ever loan money? Neither. And so what you have is revisionist writing there to create a justification for exiling these people. The fact of the matter is that Muhammad and his first Muslims didn't work, so they borrowed money. They survived on borrowed money from the Jews and didn't want to pay them back. And second, that the Quran was based on twisted Talmud stories, and Muhammad didn't want them revealing that and exposing him. So he attacked them and exiled them. We'll return because the story only gets worse from here, and the more you know, the better you'll be prepared to understand today's events. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. For those who are listening today and would like to ask David a question, our number is 877-300-7645. We are here with David Hayden, who has agreed to stay on with us during the next hour. He is the author of a new book on Islam's beginnings called Muhammad and the Birth of Islamic Supremacism, The War with the Jews. David, let me pick up where we left off. You've acknowledged that Muhammad, who was a usurper in Yathrib, shortly after he arrived there, he exiled an entire community of Jews, stealing their homes and stealing their property. Was there anything that could be used to say, well, these Jews deserve that because they tried to exile the Muslim immigrants into Yathrib, or that they went off and killed a bunch of Muslims, or they systematically robbed a group of Muslims? Is there anything that can be used to say that cause and effect started before Muhammad exiled them?
I couldn't find anything that relates to that at all. I mean, they were in charge of the marketplace. They were thrifty people, and their livelihoods were based on their own hard work and so on. But it just seemed like, as you were alluding to earlier, that you know the Muslims didn't have much when they came there. They didn't have skills apparently that it was going to enable them to survive. So they needed something. And, you know, I'd like to go back and talk, you know, even before the exile of the Qaynuqa Jews, the Battle of Badr, I think, is a defining moment in Islam. The fact that this was, and this took place about, what, 4 or 5 months? You know, the chronology is hard to really define. But the Battle of Badr was, you know, it showed that Muhammad was not the guy he's saying he was in terms of being honest and
he was a thief.
Bringing in this religion. Yes, I mean, he even before Badr there were 7 other raids, most of them were failures. But the one before Badr, the one that took place down close to Mecca at Nakhla, that's where they first, I think, first time they were actually killed a person, and after
and they kidnapped
from it.
Right.
Yes, and they kidnapped. Plus, they got some booty for the first time.
Which Mohammed himself confiscated.
That's true. At first, he didn't because it was, well, during the holy month, I shouldn't have taken that.
Yes.
We shouldn't have taken it. But then he got a revelation from
his God. Yeah, right. Convenient scriptures, I call them.
Yeah, there's a lot of those.
Yeah, there's a lot of them. The only reason I passed over those two events is that your book is research on Muhammad's war with the Jews. But you are correct. The only way it doesn't Muhammad's war against all humankind, Jews being were actually not first. He revealed his character by attacking his a caravan from his own hometown. His previous neighbors. He attacked them, killed them, robbed them, and then gloated about the confiscation of the booty.
That's true. That's true.
In fact, the Quran's 8th surah is Muhammad having his God say that stealing is lawful and good.
Yeah, not only that, in surah 8, Allah is actually involved in the action. He didn't do this. He said, "I did it. I just used you." And he talked about his angels going out and killing, cutting off their necks, and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So, Allah was gloating himself in the Quran about Israel in this also.
Yeah, it's interesting how much Allah and Muhammad have in common. Their character and their ambitions are identical, are they not?
That's true. Yes.
It tells you either a lot about Muhammad or a lot about Allah. Either they're one and the same, which is a possibility. I don't think it's the most likely possibility. I came to the conclusion that Allah is Satan, and that Muhammad, by his own admission, was demon-possessed. And so a demon-possessed man and the demon that possesses him are often identical in character, which is why the attack at Badr, that the first Islamic war, if you will, which wasn't a war, it was an armed raid against a civilian caravan. Why it is recorded so gloriously in the Quran?
Yeah, and what's amazing about this? I mean, you take all these battles that we're talking about here, including Badr. It's always the other guy that caused it. In every case, the Kainuka caused their own exile because they really wouldn't believe in Muhammad and his messenger. That's what it really comes down to. And the same thing with Nadir, and the same thing with the Quraysh. They all started these wars because they wouldn't accept Muhammad as the messenger of Allah.
We'll be back in a moment with David. This is Shattering Myths.
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of longevity.